BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. I think we're all a lot happier to see the sunshine's finally coming out at long last. I've spent many evenings dozing off in Queen Square on the grass. This week we have live musicians in the studio. Harry Hornsey, acoustic guitarist from Bristol, and Tim Page from Exmouth and Devon are here to play blues and ragtime on their guitars. They'll play a duet and a tune each. We also hear about the Icelandic bank crash. What can we learn from their banking collapse? First of all, though, we've got Tony Gosling with the news.
Decisions made during the final months of the Bush administration created an environment in which the most politically connected investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, not only flourished but saw their competitors laid waste, with firms like Lehman in bankruptcy and others like Merrill Lynch and Bank of America forced to merge in desperate hope of surviving. Two recent news stories raised some interesting questions about Goldman Sachs. In the secretive world of investment banking and federal regulation, these reports shed light on the question of where to draw the line between routine financial transactions and problematic conflicts of interest. The first story ran on the cover of a recent edition of Barron's Resurrection on Wall Street. It documents in some detail the success of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley as Wall Street's sole standouts. The story, which refers to the government support each institution has received, concludes they're both making attempts to adapt to the new financial realities, combined with the decline of their competitors, that makes them good bets for investors now. For a couple of banks trying to boost their stock, what more could you ask for? The second story, which was covered on March the 15th by many news outlets, was based on the disclosure by the American International Group, AIG, of massive payments to domestic and foreign financial institutions and to 20 states using money provided by US taxpayers through the federal bailout. Whilst most news stories focused on payments made to non-US institutions, one of the more interesting aspects of AIG's disclosure statement is the fact that Goldman Sachs, at $12.6 billion, is the single largest beneficiary of AIG. The roots of the linkage between Goldman Sachs and AIG go back to the closing months of the Bush administration, as the financial meltdown reached crisis proportions and key decisions were made that are now reaping the whirlwind. Remember who played a key role in deciding to bail out AIG? Henry Paulson, the Goldman CEO turned George W. Bush Treasury Secretary. Paulson, according to a September the 27th New York Times piece by Gretchen Morgenson, led a team of regulators and bankers in early September to determine what to do with the most severely wounded financial institutions. One of the participants in those meetings was Lloyd C. Blankfein, Paulson's successor at Goldman Sachs. The banking and insurance industries have traditionally been amongst the most politically influential sectors. That was especially true during the George W. Bush years, when regulatory policies and tax legislation, especially cuts in the rates on dividends and capital gains income, produced a corporate bonanza. In the 2004 election, these financial interests demonstrated their gratitude by contributing hundreds of thousands to the Bush-Cheney campaign. Employees of Morgan Stanley gave Bush more than any other company, $600,000, followed by Merrill Lynch, just under $600,000, PricewaterhouseCoopers, $500,000. UBS Americas, another $500,000. Goldman Sachs gave $400,000. Credit Suisse, $300,000. Lehman Brothers, $300,000. Citigroup, $300,000. And Bear Stearns, $300,000 as well, to the campaign. The consequences of the decisions made in the private meetings chaired by Republican Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson back in September 2008 are just now coming to light. Even if transparency is modest at best, clearly when regulators and the regulated are trusted to reach decisions behind closed doors, decisions involving the financial viability of major banks, those who are regulated, operating out of the public view, will do all they can to ensure their interests are protected.
Thank you very much, Tony Gosling. As the financial catastrophe unfolds, the case of Iceland may turn out to be a lesson for us all. Michael Hudson is the author of several books, Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order, Super Imperialism, New Edition, The Origin and Fundamentals of US World Dominance, and Merchants of Misery, How Corporate America Profits from Poverty. So I think the titles would probably give away his angle there, I would say. He has a long and varied and distinguished career as a Wall Street insider, leading economist, and expert on the financial history, and research professor at the University of Missouri, I should say. And here is an interview with the said man about Iceland.
I think the first question on listeners' minds would be, why is Iceland important?
Well, it's very much like they liken themselves very much to the ex-Soviet economies, where it's a fairly egalitarian community topped by a overclass of just a few kleptocrats that are running the country. The difference is that Iceland's kleptocrats go back centuries into a very close connection between the leading families and the government, and the leading families and the government privatized the banks and natural resources, gave them to themselves for almost nothing, and then proceeded to treat the fisheries and treat the banks like their own possessions, and they gambled away hundreds of billions of dollars and lost it. These arrogant who were running Iceland had the idea that somehow they could come from the small island of the Atlantic, outsmart all of the European and American bankers, play derivatives, work apparently with Russian kleptocrats and criminals, run up hundreds of billions of dollars of losses that nobody knows where they've gone. And the suspicion I got in Iceland is that the banks lent money to Russian kleptocrats and to themselves, operating illegally out of offshore banking enclaves, and then went to Iceland and said, now that we've given hundreds of billions of dollars, imposed feudalism on the society, pushed the economy back to the 12th century, and imposed huge taxes for centuries on the people, now you have to borrow the money from the International Monetary Fund to bail out our banks and pay by taxing the citizens at large. Iceland did invite the International Monetary Fund in to say, you know, what do we do in a case like this? But the former prime ministers that I spoke to said under no condition are they going to go along with this power grab. It's really the old feudal oligarchy. Iceland is a feudal nobility system that has tried to modernize itself by becoming a kind of post-Stalinist state.
One quick question, Michael. You mentioned what Sweden did going to the IMF. Are you talking about Sweden in the current crisis or back in the early 1990s?
Right now, it wasn't Sweden that went to it. It persuaded the government to go to the IMF. And the problem is that for all the post-Soviet economies, when they were left, when they got their freedom from Russia in 1991, they didn't have any single industry in their countries. The Soviet Union had dispersed industry all over its various republics, so that a part of each industry, part of autos, part of computers, was made in each republic, but no republic had a self-sustaining industry. So there was really nothing that they could export except agricultural products to pay for their imports. So how did they do this? They all ran a very heavy trade deficit because almost all of their consumer goods and machinery and capital goods were imported, and they paid for it essentially by borrowing mortgage credit for their real estate bubble in foreign currency. And because they emerged from communism with no debt at all, here you had buildings without debt, infrastructure without debt, it was a field day for Scandinavian banks in the Baltics and for Austrian banks in Hungary and Central Europe. And so the European banks lent mortgages and other loans in denominated in euros and sterling and Swiss francs and foreign currency to the post-Soviet economies that announced that they'd hoped to join the euro one day, But meanwhile, they were trying to modernize, and they had been under the impression that when they said they wanted to join Europe, Europe was going to help them become like Europe. It was going to help them develop their own industry and develop their own living standards. And instead, Europe looked at them as customers, not only customers for its exports, but as customers for its bank loans. And the last thing Europe wanted to do was help them develop. They tried to turn the post-Soviet economies into banana republics and did pretty much what the United States did in Guatemala and Central America. They used the IMF and the World Bank to promote backwardness and dependency, and the result is that once the real estate had borrowed as much foreign currency as it could be loaded down with, how were these countries going to pay for their imports? How was Hungary going to pay for its imports when nobody was going to bid up Budapest property prices even more? How was Latvia going to pay for its imports when prices in Riga were already as high as they were in Germany or even in many parts of England? So the result is that their currencies are collapsing, just as Iceland's currency is collapsing. Iceland's in an even worse condition in one sense because the banking sector there, given the fact that it's a financial dictatorship, said that in addition to paying high mortgages on your property, we're indexing your mortgages. We're not going to index your wages, although it's contractual. The Icelandic government said all contracts to labor are illegitimate. Only contracts to wealthy people count. Only contracts to the oligarchy count. And to the extent that the consumer price index goes up or the currency decays, as a result of our debt outflow, we're going to index the mortgages. And since the currency went down 17% last year, Icelanders now have to pay an interest rate of 17% in addition to the 6% mortgage rate. That's 23% per year mortgages. They cannot walk away from the houses as they can here, so they've been reduced to debt peonage. Iceland is the Icelandic ruling class is trying to reduce the entire country to feudalism, tying the people to the land, to their homes like serfs, forcing them with over a century of labor to turn over to the nobility that's conquered it financially rather than militarily, all with the support of the World Bank and especially England.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to welcome to the studio Mr. Chris Scott, a local blues singer and guitarist. Hi.
How you doing?
How long have you lived in Bristol? Are you a true local?
No. I wasn't born here, but I've been here since about 1976.
All right.
So it's...
I think you're a Bristolian.
Honorary, perhaps, you know.
Okay, whereabouts do you live?
I live south of the river.
South of the river.
South of the river, yeah.
Okay. How long have you been playing the guitar?
Forty years.
Okay. What is your sort of earliest memory of music when you were a nipper? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Leicestershire, and earliest memory of music, I think the first thing that really got me going was listening to old New Orleans jazz.
Okay.
And some of the kind of, because some of that gets quite dark, and I didn't realise at the time, but that was, you know, fairly blues orientated, you know, with all those kind of trademarks, and that's what really sparked me up to begin with.
Okay. Did you sort of take up playing an instrument of your own accord, or was there a bit of sort of parental pressure to learn, or how did you...?
No, not really. I mean, did the usual school thing, you know, where they lumber you with a euphonium and that kind of stuff, and then that goes back and you get something a bit lighter. But my first instrument was a trumpet.
Right.
And I used to play that, and then I had to give that up when I lost my teeth in a motorcycle accident.
You seem to have a fine set of lashes that I'm looking at the moment.
They're all false, yeah.
All false, yeah. So what led you to play the guitar? You started off playing a lot of brass instruments and listened to jazz. What kind of made you pick up the guitar?
Well, to begin with, I was just I was just a singer in some bands, and I got kind of fed up with not being able to control the dynamic of what was going on.
Okay.
And so I took up the guitar to be able to do that, really. But it's kind of taken over in its own right, you know, rather than it just being a means to an end. It's a, you know, it's a joy for its own sake now.
Okay. You've got an excellent voice for the blues, just listening to your voice, Husky. Have you ever been a smoker?
Oh, yeah. Man and boy.
Just to get. So what are your influences in blues? You wound up playing blues. I'm imagining maybe you started off playing a lot of sort of rock music, perhaps, or sort of in the 70s, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I could point to a number of things, but I think really the main influence actually is really coming from jazz, you know, like Miles Davis and his sense of space, you know, and his kind of melodic sensibilities that he's got. It's always been a great influence, rather than traditional rock heroes, you know.
Yeah. Is there something about the sort of the timbre of the guitar then? I mean, you played the trumpet and you've influenced a lot by jazz and listening to Miles Davis. Trumpet's pretty easy to sort of cart about. Why did you kind of move away from the trumpet and pick up the guitar?
Lost my teeth, dude. Told you.
Oh, yeah. But you must have... I mean, I'm thinking, well, as a tuning kind of, you get sort of new teeth. Is that still an...
No, you need your own teeth. You can't do it with crowns because there's so much pressure you put on.
Ah, right. That's very interesting. Okay.
There you go. Learn something new every day.
I have. Who have you worked with in your career?
Who have I worked with? Well, you know... People here and there, really.
Okay.
We haven't got time enough to go through some of that, and some of that's classified information.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
That's a bit ominous. I don't know. You can't tell me that and then just expect me to move on.
Yeah, I know. Really. That was a total wind-up, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally.
no, not really. Nobody any famous. I played with some really good people over the years, you know, jammed here and there. I mean, at one time I was touring in the States and Canada, and you bump into people there, and then you find out later, you know, oh, that was so-and-so, was it? Okay. Bob Seger in Canada, that was fun.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You're on the same bill as...
No, it was just a kind of casual thing. I mean, the scene over there is really, it's really loose, you know. I mean, there's all these venues over there, you know, which are just... I mean, it's going to sound really glamorous, this. It's not. Most of them are scuzz holes. They're just kind of pubs with a PA in.
Right.
But... there's less of this kind of rock starry kind of thing that goes on.
Mm.
And so, you know, you can go down a club like the Silver Dollar and you can just bump into, you know, people, really world-class players who are just kind of hanging out there, you know, not doing the rock star thing, just having a beer. And
right, I mean, a lot of people, I guess, especially of my generation, the idea is that you want to make sort of, you give up your day job, that's the dream, isn't it? And pick up the guitar and you head out into the Blue Yonder.
Yeah.
How did that work out?
That's a nice dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
Does
no.
It work?
No, it's playing music for a living is hazardous at best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did. It was my living, and it was my income for many years. But after too many years of being really broke, very damaging for relationships as well, especially if you have children, because you're never there. You have to. You are tied to the road. You are tied to playing rubbish gigs for rubbish money.
Mm.
Just to make the rent, and it doesn't work.
So when you played guitar, were you always predominantly solo, or were you playing with bands?
Both.
Both.
Mm.
Any, what were the names of your bands? Were they already just...
Actually, it's quite weird, because in May, I've got two records coming out, on download only, on Bristol Archive Records. Stuff that I did back in the 80s,
yeah.
with two separate bands. It was just quite bizarre that we're waiting 30 years to hear those. Names of the bands. Decay Sisters was a good band I had, followed by The Royal Assassins. We had a deal with a label in London on that, which all went horribly wrong. And then I suppose after that, the most kind of... the band with the highest profile was a band called Crawdaddy, I was working with Steve Payne in.
Yeah.
And we did a TV series which HTV showed and then shelved, and that was our big bid for huge global domination.
Okay.
Really worked.
Most people's musicians, when they come in and say their experiences of, well, their conception of music industry types is usually pretty low. Is that, how have you found... trying to interact with the music industry and trying to get your stuff out? How easy has relations been?
It's an industry, and as such, you know, and these days, being a musician is often viewed as being a career choice, which I think is... Oh, I can't say what I was going to say then, because this is radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an illusion.
Yeah.
It is one of the most competitive businesses to be involved with. It's one of the most avaricious businesses to be involved with, especially the way the industry is at the moment. I mean, it's the traditional model is losing money hand over fist. There is no real alternative model which is financially viable. So the established labels are starting to look at things, well, they already are doing now, these things called 360 deals, which where they start to carve into traditional areas of income that previously they couldn't touch, like royalty payments, MCPS payments, mechanicals, gig fees, and so on and so forth. Now, merchandise. Merchandise was always the moneymaker.
Yeah.
But now they're carving in for a percentage of that on these so-called 360 deals. And it's very, very tough.
How do you feel, having been in the game a long time, about the internet? It's supposed to democratise the release of music. Surely this is going to make it easier for people to be able to succeed.
Again, I mean, everybody cites the Arctic Monkeys model, but that only happened. You know, the internet was used as the kind of, oh, yeah, look, yeah, it's cool, it's for the people, it's... No, it didn't happen like that. That's another myth. I mean, the music industry's full of myths when you start looking at it. You know, it is full of myths, and that's a myth. You know, that only happened, you know. Yeah, okay, technically they got a number one through downloads alone.
Yeah.
But that only happened because of the industry interest and the mechanics that was going on in the background anyhow.
But you still got the drive to keep going, I guess, and you got a record deal with Bristol Archives. Is that going well?
It's not exactly a deal. I mean, he phones me up and says, can I put this out? And I go, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's not... I mean, that's interesting. I mean, we're dealing with material I thought would never see the light of day.
Yeah.
And it is. So that's interesting in terms of that. And it was interesting in terms of me being able to, open up the archive and have a look, see what was in there. You know, and I was listening to stuff that I hadn't heard in 30 years, and it's kind of like, okay.
Okay, what about new material? What is the world going to hear from Chris Scott in the coming years?
Don't know, really. I'm still playing, I'm still writing, but whether that'll go out on anything other than, you know, a download or a stream on a website, I don't know.
Okay. What do you? I haven't spoken about the internet. Do you have an internet presence that you can advertise?
Yeah, chrisscottnet.co.uk.
chrisscottnet.co.uk. It's time to plug a gig. On the 30th of April, you are performing at the Southbank Club in Dean Lane, just south of the river in Bristol. The headliner is Chris Scott's Blues Devil, and the support are Abel Mabel. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3. And we'd like to play a track of yours that you brought along. What are we going to play?
This is a tune called Wicked Tongue. It's off an album that I cut with the live band. And the live band is, you know, it's a fun kind of thing. We just get up there and we make a racket and see where it takes us. And this is actual fact is off a live album that we cut a couple of years ago. And it's called Wicked Tongue Blues.
Say your wicked tongue, darling, cut my heart in two. Your wicked tongue, baby, cut my heart in two. You can't fix it up now, baby, no matter what you do. Well,
I'd say thank you to Chris Scott for coming in. He has now gone off into the night on his journey. So don't forget to look out for him. That's at the 30th of April, on the 30th of April, at the South Bank Club in Dean Lane, Bristol. And it's only £3 to get in. What a bargain. I'd like to introduce now some more music. Two more guitarists, Harry Hornsey and Tim Page. And I believe, Tim, you're going to introduce what you're about to play.
This song's called Send Me to the Electric Chair. And we like to dedicate it to all those lovely amenity companies out there. Judge, do you wanna hear my plea before you open up your court? I don't want no sympathy, 'cause I done cut my good gal's throat. You know I caught her with some no good man that I'd before I had my knife, I went insane, and the rest you ought to know. I said, Judge, please, Mr. Judge, send me to the electric chair. Judge, oh, Judge, oh, good kind Judge, why don't you fry me, 'cause I don't care. I wanna take a journey to the devil down below. I killed my baby, gotta read just what I sow. I said, Judge, please, Mr. Judge, send me to the electric chair. Electric chair. Judge, oh, Judge, good
can't judge, just burn me, cause I don't care.
You know I got her in my bottle. I kicked her in the side. I stood there laughing over while she wallowed round and died. I said, just please, sandwiches, electric.
I'd like to introduce personally to the chair, Tim Page, to have a little chat. Hello, Tim.
Hello, good evening.
How long have you been playing the guitar? You got
45 years, something like that. Yeah.
45 years. Yeah. How old would you have been when you first
played? I was 17 when I started. I'm 62 now, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What were you listening to at the time? There was a bit of a blues explosion.
Well, there was, yes. It was. I was at a public school, and which is a bit like being in a you know, in the Southwest prisons in America. In those days, you got whipped, you know what I mean? And I heard Lead Belly, basically. It was Lead Belly did it for me.
Okay.
But, I'd heard Chuck Berry and all this sort of rock and rolls before, who I really liked.
Yeah.
You know, after Elvis and all that stuff. And I'd liked this traditional jazz boom. And so at the same time, I was around the time I got to know Lead Belly, it was Jelly Roll Morton and people like that, the Dixieland jazz bands from the 20s, you know. And, but I heard Lead Belly and that was it, that's what I wanted to do.
When you learnt to play the guitar, where did that take you? Did you start playing in bands? Where did you take up blues rock? Or
No. I started off just playing at home, and I went to a few folk clubs and stuff. And actually, I mean, I've had a bit of a up and down history myself in terms of the different things I've done at different times, and I didn't really play in public very much at all.
Right.
And in fact, I didn't really get into that until I was in my 40s, really.
Right.
And then I was incredibly shy about playing in front of people. And
you solved that somewhere. Yeah. All the time.
Well, I used to play for this guy who was a performer,
yeah.
and I used to drive him around and lend him my PA and he'd give me a bit of money for it, and he'd put me on in his interval.
Okay.
And slowly I got into it from there, really, yeah.
So you put a lot of your own personal sort of history into the songs. Do you write songs of your own?
I've written some music, but without words, really.
Okay.
I won't go into the details of it, but I can't seem, for some reason, I'd rather write blues songs. They all seem a bit trite when I write them, you know, and I listen to somebody else, like, well, that's clever, you know, what they've done with it. But it all seems a bit trite when I do it, so I haven't really got around to doing it. The only thing I thought I might do is do what John Lee Hooker tended to do, which was just make it up as you go along.
Okay.
And so I'm sort of basing my act a bit on that,
okay.
Having a go. I mean, like that crying in that song there. Just one day I decided to do it.
Yeah.
And some people went, he's mad. But part of me, I mean, part of it helped me be more extroverted or whatever, you know, give me more confidence, okay. And so now I just, you know, I try things out and see whether they work or not, you know.
Well, blues has gone through a lot of peaks and troughs in popularity. I mean, the blues explosion of the 60s is long gone. What do you think of the blues scene today? And, you know, you've got a young man here, you've talked to play.
Well, Harry's amazing, yeah. I mean, I've known Harry for about 4 or 5 years, and I think he was about 14 when I first met him. But he's you know, into the sort of blues that I do, sort of thing. But there's a lot of young people coming up who do completely differently. Really sort of invented the blues that I hear every now and then, and some of them are really good. You know, some of the old buffers my age go, "Oh, I got what he's doing." You know, but I listen to them, I think, "No, really, really good." You know, they've taken it somewhere else, which is what each generation should do.
Yeah. What do you do to sort of pass on the gift of guitar playing? Do you teach guitar?
I do, actually. I've just started in a guitar retreat in Bude, which goes under the name of guitarretreats.com, I think. Stuart Marshall runs it. Anyway, if you Google that in, you'll sort of get it. And basically, you get half a dozen people in a hotel for a three-day thing over the weekend. And he does the main thing, and it tends to be at the end of getting people who haven't played very much in public together and doing it. Okay. And on a Saturday night we have a show and everybody does it, and you know, we've got them happy and confident and doing stuff. People who never met each other,
yeah,
you know, and we met at a camp where that stuff was going on in the first place, and that's our ethos, basically. That's what we want to happen here.
Well, thank you to Tim Page. I'd now like to turn to Harry Hornsey. Hello.
Hello.
Loving the Buddy Holly glasses, by the way.
That's oh, yeah. You know, I was trying to look for some vintage ones for ages, and I finally found a pair which fit me.
Okay. How old are you, may I ask?
I'm 19.
How did you wind up being interested in blues?
It's a bit of a mystery, I think. When I was small, my sister used to play records of Elvis and the Beatles to me. I think she's much older than me, so she was 18 years older than me, so she's interested in... trying to not let me go down a really naff sort of pop route, I think.
So she was trying to encourage you to not be a really annoying little brother.
I guess so, but at the same time, she didn't... no one in my family seems to know very much about blues, so when I listened to that stuff, I loved it, particularly Elvis, and I thought, well, that's great. And started, instead of everyone else, I think lots of people have that sort of experience when they're young, but most people go forwards and look at who those people influenced. I kind of... went backwards and looked at who influenced them, so I'm sort of finally working right back to pretty much archive recordings that you can barely hear through the scratches of Blind Lemon Jefferson and Blind Blake and things like that now.
Okay, how did you meet Tim?
We were at a sort of jam, blues jam, down in Ashburton in Devon.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, in there about 14, 15, sort of unable to play really with a guitar, and a friend of mine who plays bass, and we just sort of turned up and did a pretty... mean looking sort of blues, which was pretty, you know, ropey.
Yeah.
But it was great to go along there, because I was listening to lots of Muddy Waters records at that time, sort of at that sort of Chicago blues, and I went there and I heard, you know, not quite the same thing, but something coming close to it, and it was incredible. And a couple of years of doing that, or more than that, and really I learned a huge amount from Tim and the other guys there who have spent, you know, best part of the lifetime studying the music.
Are you sort of gigging around at the moment, on your own? Or
yeah, I'm doing. I do a few things around Totnes. Around Bristol. I come from Totnes, so that's why I'm confused. I'm doing playing in the lab just off Corn Street on the.
Okay.
Supporting the Zen Hussies.
Oh,
that's
wow!
That's on the 16th of May. So that's the next sort of big one. So that's going to be hopefully a good one.
What would you like to play for us today?
I'm going to play a track which has been recorded recently and put on the Coen Brothers film, you know, the one.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Exactly that. That's the one. But that's in the kind of country version. I'm going to do it in a bit more like Blind Blake did it in the 1920s sort of time.
Okay.
But actually based on a recording which I've heard from a duo from Santa Barbara in America called Tom Ball and Kenny Sultan. So that's what I'm going to do, kind of ragtime.
Brilliant. Take it away.
Blackjack, dice, and poker. 40 I remember last election, everybody in the world in action, they're trying to elect my president. Not from my name, Bill Austin, but from New York to Boston, looking for an honest settlement. Last Friday, I met a little girl named Lottie. I swore she was the prettiest girl in town. She started calling me honey, and I started to spend my money. We went into a pub and we sat down. Well, folks, I was really in it. I was buying a drink a minute. I was buying champagne and whiskeys by the dozen. When I went to pay that man, I done found that lady's hand in my pocket where my money was. She's at two. She's in the graveyard now. She's in the graveyard now. I told that judge right to his face, that lady's hand was out of its place. She's in the graveyard now, pushing up daisies. She's in the graveyard.
What you call music for dancing to. That's brilliant. Again, you're playing on the 16th of May in the Lab on Broad Street.
That's the one.
Supporting the Zen Hussies. Thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now it's time for the last episode of the History of the Mafia, the Crime and the Underworld. This is your last taster. This is Malcolm Greaves, the actor, reading from David Southwell's book.
History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. When it comes to aliases and nicknames, it is hard to beat the sheer number that some criminals manage to acquire during their careers in organised crime. However, one man that could match even the most titled gangster was James Jesus Angleton, the long-serving CIA Director of Counterintelligence. Although his official CIA cover name was Hugh Ashmead, and his code designation was KU/Mother, Angleton clocked up more than 50 other names during more than 3 decades of espionage work. At CIA headquarters, many referred to him as the Grey Ghost of Langley, a coincidental echo of the name the Sicilian Mafia gave him, the Ghost. Angleton is a giant figure in the annals of spying. The orchid-growing, fly-fishing, poetry-reading, chess-playing agent began work for the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, in 1943. The OSS continued to control US intelligence until the CIA was established in 1947, the year that Angleton started working with the Mafia. As he had spent much of his childhood and teenage years in Rome, it was felt that Angleton was the perfect agent to establish an underground anti-communist network to ensure that Italy remained closely aligned to the US, and free from Soviet influence. Angleton's creation was called Gladio, utilising former SS intelligence officers and Italian fascists. It was secretly funded with millions of dollars from the CIA. Part of its purpose was to ensure that at Italian elections the results tilted towards the right. This led Angleton to devise what would later be called the Strategia della Tensione, strategy of tension. Its aim was to manipulate public opinion, not only through disinformation of propaganda, but also through acts of terrorism that could be blamed on the left. It was not surprising, therefore, that Angleton brought elements of the Sicilian Mafia into Gladio. The OSS and the Mafia had begun working together during the Second World War. In 1941, worried over acts of sabotage in American ports by German or Italian agents, and an increasing number of strikes, US intelligence brokered a deal with Cosa Nostra via Meyer Lansky. Acknowledging their virtual control over the dockyard unions, in return for moving Lucky Luciano, who was behind bars for life on prostitution charges, to a more comfortable prison, the OSS expected the Mafia to end worker dissent in the docks and assist in anti-saboteur operations. The American Mafia complied, and when the US military began planning to invade Italy in 1943, a new arrangement was brokered. Luciano would be freed and deported at the end of the war, if Cosa Nostra would guarantee its colleagues in the Sicilian Mafia would assist with the American invasion of Sicily and its peaceful occupation. Leading Cosa Nostra figure Vito Genovese, who had fled the US in 1937 and was now linked to Mussolini, also agreed to switch allegiance, provide intelligence, and help OSS operations in Italy. Angleton built on these wartime links with the Sicilian Mafia for Gladio. Mafiosi recruited by Angleton committed terrorism under the banner of left-wing groups and joined the P2 Masonic Lodge that Gladio established as a way of controlling leading Italian politicians, journalists, and even churchmen. Through Gladio funds and protection, the Mafia path to dominant political corruption within Italy was greatly smoothed. Unfortunately for Gladio, Mafia involvement in P2 eventually led to the Banco Ambrosiano scandal in 1981. This exposed the links between high-ranking members of the Vatican and leading Italian gangsters, and even put Gladio itself under the spotlight of public scrutiny. Angleton also made friends amongst leading members of the American Mafia. Following the revolution in Cuba in 1959, he knew that leading mob figures such as Sam Giancana and Santo Trafficante Jr. had lost millions of dollars, so he suggested recruiting them to help assassinate Fidel Castro. This led to a long period of CIA funding of various Cosa Nostra plots to kill the Cuban leader, all of which failed, including the attempt to kill him with an exploding cigar. When Congress investigated CIA wrongdoing through the Church Committee in 1975, they discovered not only Angleton's illegal campaigns against American citizens within America, but also his work with the Mafia. As the details of the mob-CIA relationship came out, both sides began to reflect on the wisdom of having high-placed friends in such notorious professional murder organisations. There can't be many members of the clergy with such criminal-sounding nicknames as the Gorilla. Then again, it can only be hoped that there are not too many churchmen like Archbishop Paul the Gorilla Marcinkus, who not only counted leading mafiosi as his close friends, but also became intrinsically involved in their criminal activities. Paul Marcinkus was born in the Chicago suburb of Cicero in 1922. As a young boy, he grew up hearing tales of infamous Cicero neighbours, including Al Capone, Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, and Frank the Enforcer Nitti. Yet these stories had no impact on Marcinkus' chosen career. As a teenager, he entered the seminary to study for the priesthood. It was his friends during this period that nicknamed him the Gorilla, due to his impressive 6'3", 200-pound frame. The name stuck. Everyone at the seminary remembers him as a gentle giant and a man without malice. After his ordination in 1947, Marcinkus eventually found himself sent to Rome, where he was part of the security team for two popes. Marcinkus's devotion to service and charm won him many friends within the Vatican, and he was ordained to the episcopate as titular Archbishop of Horta and secretary to the Roman Curia in 1969. This role acted as a stepping stone to his appointment as the president of the Istituto per le Opere di Religione, the Institute of Religious Works, or IOR, in 1971. The IOR acts as both the Pope's personally owned bank and the National Bank of the Vatican City in its role as an independent state. Maintaining accounts for clerics and religious organisations across the world, it controls and has access to billions of dollars of funds. It was in 1971 that Marcinkus also became a member of the P2 Freemasonry Lodge, also known as the Propaganda Dewey Lodge, that had been set up as part of CIA Director James Jesus Angleton's secret Gladio network in Italy. Despite the fact that his faith expressly forbade him from becoming a Freemason, it was through P2 that Marcinkus met fellow Mason, Michele the Shark Sindona. Renowned as a major Sicilian mafia banker and lawyer, Sindona began to advise Marcinkus on the Vatican investments. In 1972, Sindona purchased a controlling interest in New York's Franklin National Bank and used it to begin laundering mafia money. As the bank began to collapse due to fraud and bad foreign currency speculation, Sindona entered into a deal with the American and Italian mafias to distribute $950 million of counterfeit stock certificates. It emerged that Marcinkus, acting for the IOR, had purchased nearly $100 million of the worthless stock. As evidence of the scandal surfaced, New York District Attorney Frank Hogan tried to extradite Marcinkus to the U.S. to face charges over the fraud. The Vatican used political pressure to block the extradition request and refused to remove Marcinkus as president of the IOR. Being involved in one mafia banking plot should have made Marcinkus more careful about the friends he made in P2. Unfortunately for the Vatican, he was not. Marcinkus made IOR the major shareholder in the Banco Ambrosiano, run by Roberto Calvi. The Archbishop also became the co-owner, with Calvi, of the Cisalpine Bank in the Bahamas that Calvi used to launder Italian mafia drug profits. It was just one of a number of ghost banks set up by both men to handle millions of dollars of illicit money. By the time it was discovered in 1982, the Banco Ambrosiano could not account for more than $1,287 billion. Calvi fled Italy, only to be found dead within weeks in London. Despite having embroiled the Vatican in the biggest banking scandal of the 20th century and made it responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Banco Ambrosiano's debts, Marcinkus remained president of the IOR until 1989. When authorities again tried to extradite the Archbishop for questioning, Pope John Paul II made him pro-president of the Vatican City, effectively both mayor of Vatican City and its prime minister, a position equivalent to that of many heads of state and therefore exempt from legal proceedings. Marcinkus had proven a useful friend to the mafia, but it is unclear whether he actually benefited from the relationship. His own friends in high places, however, prevented any harm from coming to him. Possibly their actions were tempered by remembering Marcinkus' own words, "You can't run the church on Hail Marys alone."
That was Malcolm Greaves reading The History of the Mafia by David Southwell. We hope, as ever, I think as I said in the last couple of weeks, to be getting an interview with David Southwell fairly soon. Tony Gosling is chasing up on that. Next week we have The Diary of an Innkeeper, also read by Malcolm Greaves, and I look forward to it. Now it's time for Jeff Sparks, as ever, with the What's On Guide.
Good evening, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off on Saturday, 2nd of May, and Guns to Roses will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on 2nd of May, Eden Height will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £3 in advance and £5 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature Goldblade. This band formed in Manchester around the mid-90s and to date have released 5 albums. This is the track Strictly Hardcore, and it's from their debut album Home Turf, which was released in 1997. was Goldblade with the track Strictly Hardcore from the album Home Turf. For more information, you can check out www.goldblade.com. Moving on to Sunday, 3rd of May, Albert Lee and Hogan's Heroes will be performing at the Fleece. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Also on 3rd of May, Sonic Boom 6 will be performing at the Croft in Bristol with support from the Hit Ups and also Gecko. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6.50 in advance. Finally, on Monday, 4th of May, Saxon will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol with support from Doro and also Sweet Savage. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £16.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jeff. Definitely the Sonic Boom 6 are very much worth seeing. My boss at work has been to see them 3 times. When they played at the Junction, they got a good large part of the audience to form a gigantic human pyramid in the middle of the dance floor. I'm sure there's a health and safety law against that, but I'm sure they're going to be definitely worth seeing. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio for this week. Tim Page and Harry Hornsey were here in the studio playing blues and ragtime. And thank you to Chris Scott for coming in. He found us at last. Malcolm Grieve read the last instalment of The History of the Mafia by David Southwell. Next week, of course, A Diary of an Innkeeper. Jess Marks brought us the What's On in Bristol and around town. Go and see Sonic Boom 6. Studio engineer was Phyllis Trichcurran. In next week's show, Keith Donoghue, the town clerk of Wells and Somerset, will be the guest in the studio, and hopefully we'll be able to persuade him to sing a few songs. Keith was a former chorister of the Savoy Chapel in London and a great fan of the Dorley Cart Company and knew some of the principals in the company. And his piece about the medieval music from the church in Oust, we will try and fit in next week. I have been the producer for this week's show, and I think we've all learned our lesson because I did a very bad job of trying to present and produce at the same time. So next week, Anthea Page will be doing an excellent job of producing the show. Thank you very much. You can tune in to us on BCFM 93.2 and check out dialectradio.co.uk. Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.